Amen. Hey, as you take a seat, Daniel chapter 1, if you have your Bibles. Daniel chapter 1. If you don't have a Bible, there should be one somewhere around you. If not, you'll see the words on the screen in just a little bit. But Daniel chapter 1. It was the spring semester of my sophomore year in high school, and it was my first year to start varsity for the Ponca City Wildcats soccer team. And we were pretty good that year. We actually set a record for most wins in a single season, which has not been broken since then. And so we were pretty good, and we were very high on ourselves. Not in a good way. We were very high on ourselves, and it showed when we got into the playoffs. Now, the first game of the playoffs, we killed some Tulsa team like 7-0. Like, we just dominated that game, and so which caused us to be more high on ourselves until we got to the quarterfinals. We got into the quarterfinals, we had to play Broken Arrow. And Broken Arrow was, and I'm sure still is, a powerhouse when it came to high school soccer. And they are like a machine on the field. And so we get into that game, and within the first few minutes, we got, figuratively speaking, punched in the mouth. They came after us. And I played right outside defense, and I had never been in a game where I was so offensively overwhelmed by the opponents. I mean, they just kept coming and kept coming and kept coming, and we were running left, we were running right, we were running all around the place just trying to keep up, and they just kept shooting and kept shooting and kept shooting on our goal. And it was terrible, and within just a few minutes, we were overwhelmed, we were exhausted, and depleted, and they had already scored 2 goals. And what we learned is that we had entered into a war, but we were woefully unprepared to engage and to face our enemy. Listen, there is a truth presented to us in Scripture, a truth that revealed the state of the world in Jesus' day, but it's also a truth that still rings true in our day. We're at war. There is an enemy, and we're in his territory. To borrow a title from an old movie, we are behind enemy lines. And this enemy we're fighting, according to the Bible, is not flesh and blood. This enemy is unseen and is unparalleled in producing a kind of strategy or scheme in our world and in our culture and in our community and in your household, seeking to cause deception, division, destruction, but ultimately death. As we read in the New Testament, he's come to steal, kill, and to destroy on all levels. We could talk about mental health. We could talk about emotional health or spiritual health. We could also talk about physical health. He is coming to deceive, to divide, to destroy, to kill. And so you and I cannot be naive. We must know that we're at war. And we must not be woefully unprepared to engage our enemy. So that, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 2:11, so that Satan will not outsmart or outwit us, for we are familiar, we know his evil schemes. And it's his evil schemes that I want to narrow in on today. And we're going to look at his evil schemes more practically next week. Because next week we'll see how his schemes are presently at work, specifically in the realm of truth, identity, and sexuality. We'll look at how we got here and what's our response. Now, just as a way of a recap from last week, we began a 3-week series entitled, as you see on the screen, Shifting Sands. Because a crisis is splintering our culture, it's a kind of chaos and confusion in the realm of truth, identity, and sexuality, which is no doubt impacting you. It's impacting you personally, it's impacting somebody in your family, It's impacting a friend, a coworker, somebody you know about. No matter what angle we look at this from, this hits home. I know it does with me. I know it does with you. So the question is then what do we do? How do we act? How do we as the church, how do we react? What do we say? What do we not say? What is to be our stance? What should be our disposition towards those in the church, believers, versus those outside the church, unbelievers? Ultimately, though, my prayer for this series, especially when we get into the stuff next week, is that our discussion will prove fruitful for you in navigating this crisis, maybe for yourself, for your family, or for those you know, but that we would come out of this series with a firm footing on the rock of Jesus, with perhaps healing, if that's what's needed, or wisdom, or perhaps understanding or discernment, but also definitely that we would come out of this series with a missional mindset. A missional mindset to go and reach the culture for Christ. Because so many are being swept out to sea by the tides of the times, which was the title of last week's message. As a king tide, if you will, has come upon us. Now, as we saw last week, king tides, according to multiple sources, are the highest tides there are that you can experience at sea or there at the beach. King tides occur when the orbits and the alignment of the earth, moon, and sun combine perfectly to produce the greatest tidal effects of the year, which means they're powerful. They're very strong. And that means if you're standing at the edge of the ocean, when the king tide comes, you better be watchful. You better be on guard. You better know what's happening. You better have your feet planted not on shifting sand, but on a firm foundation, or else you may just be swept away. And so in order to stand firm on the rock of Jesus, we must know that we're at war, and we must know the schemes of our enemy. For his schemes are like the continual rhythm of the waves of a king tide, hitting against us over and over and over again, like broken arrow coming after just over and over again. So we must be on guard against these schemes so that he may not outwit us, and so that we can adequately know how to steer ourselves and others out of or away from these schemes. And so today I want to look at just kind of an overview of his scheme. And then next week, again, we're going to dive into practically how this scheme is at work today and how we're to respond to it on a cultural level, but also on a personal level. But know this, how we got here, and on this cultural moment that we're in, was not by accident, nor did it happen overnight. Oh, it's that younger generation. No, this is multi-generational. This did not happen overnight, nor is what we are experiencing the first time that humanity has encountered this scheme. Matter of fact, we could go all the way back to the garden and see how this scheme repeats itself over and over and over again. As Paul would say, we know the evil one's schemes. You say, well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean? What does it look like? Well, let's look at Daniel 1, and we'll see his scheme in action. So look at Daniel 1, verse 1, and this is what we read. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, into Babylon's hand, along with some of the vessels or objects from the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar. So Nebuchadnezzar brings them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed these objects, these vessels, in the treasury of his God. Verse 3. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youth without blemish, of good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace. And to teach them, so bring them here, and then to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans or the Babylonians. Verse 5, the king, Nebuchadnezzar, assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. And they were to be educated for 3 years. And at the end of that time, they were then to stand before King Nebuchadnezzar, verse 6, and among those taken, among those in this group, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them new names. Daniel he called Belshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Now the world you and I inhabit is God's world. He's the creator of this universe, the creator and the sustainer of this world. The physical world, matter itself, is not evil. It's broken, but it's not evil. However, there is what the Bible calls the ruler of the air. And this ruler is present and active in this world. He is the ruler, as one source puts it, of a malevolent, a wicked, evil system. He's the ruler of this system which is hostile to God. It's a system that is lost in sin, wholly at odds with anything divine. It is a system that is ruined and depraved. And this ruler has many names: the deceiver, the accuser, the evil one. Most people know him as the Satan. The Satan and his fellow rebels, they control and govern and empower this current age of rebellion. They do this through fallen institutions and fallen individuals. It is this age of rebellion that is the current system at play in the world, in our culture, in our community, and even at work among ourselves. The current system that is in opposition to everything God. What our enemy does is he seeks to coerce and manipulate the collective, but otherwise good, institutions within the world. Marriage, sex, identity, education, government, entertainment, art, business, sports. He seeks to coerce and manipulate these institutions in order to create a system in which individuals of a given culture, community, or the world buy into and live according to his rebellious system through these otherwise good institutions. Now, how does he do it, though? How does he plant his scheme so deep within institutions, so deep within individuals of a culture, to get them to believe and live his rebellious scheme? Meaning, how does he get us to fully embrace rebellion and fully live rebellion on a micro personal level, but also on a macro cultural world level? Well, his success and his scheme happens in 4 stages. And a couple of years ago, I actually mentioned these 4 stages, as some of you might remember, but I'm going to want to peel them back more today and then next week in a more practical way. But here are the 4 stages. This is the 4 stages of his scheme: infiltrate, incarcerate, indoctrinate, and then incinerate. These are the 4 stages of his scheme that you can see repeated throughout history on a personal level, but also on a much bigger level. And it works something like this. First and foremost, he infiltrates. He seeks to get in there. He seeks to find a way into the system, into the institution, into the mind, into the home, right? He's like a nasty rat that seeks to find his way into your house. That's why rats are demonic, okay? But he infiltrates institutions of society or culture, meaning he somehow gets access. He gets access. And once he does, he then gets an established grip on the institutions, whether it's education or government or marriage or sex or identity or family, community, or even the church. And then he begins to manipulate those institutions through lies. As Jesus would say, it's his native language, lies, deception. So he uses that infiltration then to incarcerate people, to take them captive, to grab a hold of them, to tie them up, to bind them. It could be physically, yes, but it also could be spiritually, and no doubt it could be mentally. So he seeks to infiltrate and then incarcerate. And once he has done the incarceration phase, he then begins the indoctrination phase. And he indoctrinates through two steps. He indoctrinates through deconstruction, but then also through reconstruction. What do I mean by deconstruction? Tear down. Get rid of. Deconstruct identities or institutions. Deconstruct them down to the very base, to the very core. And then through reconstruction, introduce confusion and chaos in the mind, the heart, the soul, the body of an individual or a culture, and then from that messy sand or shifting sand, reconstruct, rebuild a sea of rebels who will not just conform, they will want to conform and bow down to the enemy's constructed image. And he is always constructing an image that stands at odds with God's. Whatever that image is, it stands in complete contrast to God. We've seen him do this on a personal level. We've seen him do it on a regional level. And as you get into the book of Revelation, you see how he'll do it on a cosmic level. It's the same scheme over and over again. So he indoctrinates through deconstruction and then reconstruction, seeking to get people to bow down to his image. And then he makes it at one point or another, and usually when he believes he can achieve the most participation, he makes it mandatory. At first it might be optional, but eventually it becomes mandatory for the community, the culture, or the world to bow down to his image. And should there be any nonconformists to his scheme, should you be anyone who swims against the current, should you not comply or not conform, then his next step, the next stage, is to incinerate you, to cut you off, to get you fired, to fine you, to throw you in jail, to have you cut off from that family or that loved one. Or, as we'll see in the case in Daniel 1 and 3, quite literally he may throw you into the fire. So the first three stages, infiltrate, incarcerate, indoctrinate, are clearly seen in what we just read in Daniel 1. The fourth stage comes in Daniel 3, and we'll look at it in just a moment. But stage 1, infiltration. The enemy, who is working in and through Babylon and King Nebuchadnezzar, comes to the city of Jerusalem, the capital of Judah at that time. This happens, according to historians, around 605 BC. So remember, at this time, the nation of Israel had been divided. 10 tribes went north, creating the kingdom of Israel. 2 tribes stayed south, creating the kingdom of Judah. And they were divided. At this point in time, the northern kingdom had already been exiled by Assyria, but now they're about to be exiled by Babylon. And so what happens? King Nebuchadnezzar comes, we see in verse 1, he comes into Jerusalem, the capital of Judah. He infiltrates the city. He gets access to the city. And then what does he do? Well, we read, he besieged the city. It's a word that literally means to tie up, to bind. He incarcerates Jerusalem. But really what he's doing is incarcerating the Jews that still found their home in Judah. So he infiltrates the city, he gets access to it, and then he incarcerates the Jews. And during this incarceration, as we read, he takes some objects from the house of the true God and then puts them into the house of his false gods. One commentator writes that this practice was very common in that day and age. The act symbolized the supremacy of the deities of the conquering nation over the gods of the peoples and the nations defeated by them. So meaning he infiltrates, then incarcerates, he takes them captive, and then declares, by taking those vessels from them and putting them in the house of his false god, he declares supremacy over them. I'm more powerful, I'm stronger than any god that you even talk about or refer to. He declares supremacy over them. One source summarized it like this, describing what happened to these Israelites. The Israelites, the people of Yahweh, the true and eternal God, they lost possession of their land. They had their temple razed. They had the office of kingship eradicated. All of this happened in one fell swoop in the raiding hordes of King Nebuchadnezzar and the gods of Babylonia. So what happens next then? Well, the king then orders that the young men be brought back to him to his paradise, so to speak, in Babylon. And this is crucial. Who he targets is crucial. The word for young men can mean children. It can mean youth. Most believe them to be more like teenagers, somewhere around 13 to 17 years of age. So they were young, but they were also of royal noble birth. They possessed great potential, meaning he targeted the future influencers and leaders of the culture. That's who he had brought to him. This was, you might say, the next generation. He came after their young minds. He came after their hearts, their souls, their very bodies. He targeted the next generation. So he infiltrates the city and the culture, their lives. He then incarcerates them, takes them captive, targeting the next generation. And from there, he begins the indoctrination phase. This doesn't happen over a weekend. It doesn't happen with just one little video. It happens over the course of 3 years. 3 years of indoctrination. And through that indoctrination phase, he utilized deconstruction and reconstruction. He deconstructs their identity all the way down to changing their birth given names, which, mind you, is very successful. We now remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not for their Hebrew God-given, birth-given names, but by their Babylonian names. That's how good he is. And so he changes their names, and this is very, very intentional. To see the intentionality, just think about what these names mean, right? Let's look first at the Hebrew names, right? So you had Daniel, which means God is my judge. That's what it means in Hebrew. Then you had Hananiah. In the Hebrew, what the meaning of this name is, Yahweh has been gracious. The true and eternal God has been gracious to me. Then you have Mishael, which means who is God? It's an expression that means like who is like God? There is no other. And then Azariah means Yahweh has helped. And so these birth-given names point their attention, point us, the reader's attention, to the true and eternal God. But the enemy, though, who seeks to deconstruct that, changes their identity to conform to a Babylonian identity. And here's what those names mean, the new Babylonian names that were given to them. Belshazzar, which was given to Daniel, means Bel protects his life. Bel is a name that refers to Marduk, who was the supreme god of the Babylonian pantheon. Shadrach means I am fearful of Aku. Aku was the Sumerian moon god. Then you have Meshach. His name that was changed, it means this. Who is what the god of Aku is? Literally, he flips it and says, who is like the god of Aku? There is no other. And then you have Abednego, which means the servant of Nabu. Nabu was, in their belief system, the son of Marduk and a patron deity. So he deconstructs them. Literally seeks to deconstruct their identity. Why? Because listen to this. A major goal of the enemy's deconstruction is to get you to turn from the true God to a false God. It's why he seeks to deconstruct. To try and get you to turn from the true God to a false God. That you would change your allegiance from the God who created you, that you would change your allegiance from who God created you to who the enemy wants you to be. That you would decide for yourself right and wrong in your own eyes. That you would get to be like God's. All you got to do is take of the fruit that he offers. So he seeks to deconstruct in order to get you to turn from the true God to a false God. Then after deconstructing them, he reconstructs them, and he does this for 3 years. He trains them, he teaches them to know, believe, and live Babylonian everything. He even puts them on the king's diet. This isn't just a mental process. He wants it to be a physical process as well. One person said that for these Hebrew boys, this next generation of Hebrews, to step into this Babylonian culture and to study Babylonian literature was to enter a completely alien thought world. Another person summarized it this way: the Babylonian training and teaching was essentially a program of indoctrination in the worldview of the conquering Babylon. The reprogramming included studies in the language and literature of Babylon, a special diet, and training in royal protocol. Their desired outcome was reorientation of the exiled individuals or the captivated individuals in their thoughts, beliefs, and practices of Babylon. And the changing of their names was to drive loyalty to a new king, a new nation, and new gods. So indoctrination included deconstruct their identities, everything about who they are, and then reconstruct them into a new identity, one that conforms to the new ruling power. Yet, you have these four young men. These four young men remained firm on the rock, true to Yahweh, true to the faith in God, despite their peers, most likely, based on the context, not doing so. And they abstained from conforming to the culture over conforming to God. And that, for the enemy, carries consequences. Your loyalty to Jesus carries consequences. So in Daniel chapter 3, if you flip over there, you'll see that time passes. And King Nebuchadnezzar has constructed a statue, a golden image that looked something like this. And after he constructs this golden image, he then celebrates it. He hosts a dedication party with all the influencers of the culture, all the leaders of the culture, to do what? To celebrate this image, this multicolored, brilliant image. And then he decides to give the command for the culture to bow down and worship this constructed image. It was law, mandatory. And what we see in verse 7 of chapter 3 is all the people bow down. The culture bowed down to the image. They conform their lives to this image, except three Hebrews. Now, Daniel is not present. Most people think that he's off on assignment somewhere else in this particular time and location. But these three Hebrews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are there. And as we find out in verse 12 of that chapter, they paid no attention to the king and his law. They neither served his gods nor worshipped the image of gold. They abstained from it. As a result, they are brought before the king, who said to them, "Listen, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, and every kind of music, because maybe you didn't hear the law the first time, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. So I'm going to give you this ultimatum now. I'm going to bring you to me. I'm going to describe to you what is required of you now. When you hear the music, you're to fall down and worship the image that I have made, said King Nebuchadnezzar. But if you don't worship, if you don't conform, if you don't fully bow down, then you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. The enemy will incinerate you. And then who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? And their only response in this entire scene, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they answer the king. And you can see this verse 16 through 18. They said, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. We don't need to defend ourselves. If this be so, what you're saying, then our God whom we serve is able to deliver us. As we sang earlier, the battle belongs to him. He's able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hands. But if not, if we should enter the fire, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Well, at this point, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury. Matter of fact, the author tells us that his expression in his face was changed against them, meaning he held them in high regards at first, but now because of this refusal to conform, he's now adamantly against them. And he is filled with rage, so much so that he says, turn the furnace up 7 times hotter, meaning get it as hot as it possibly can go. I want to incinerate these 3 Hebrews. It was so hot that even the helpers were burned. And so here you have these men, these 3 Hebrew boys, bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments. They're full with all this just garments on, their clothes, and then they were thrown into the burning, fiery furnace. He says it like this in verse 23. These 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound. They were bound. And they fell into the burning, fiery furnace. Again, at one point or another, and usually when he believes he can achieve the most participation, the enemy makes it mandatory for the community, the culture, or the world to bow down to his image. Meaning there's coming a time when he will make it mandatory for you to bow down to his image, whatever that image is. Why? Because it keeps happening. Over and over again. This is his scheme. And should there be any nonconformist, should you not conform to his scheme, should there be anyone who swims against the current, should you cling to the rock of Jesus, he will seek to incinerate you. They hung Jesus on a tree. What do you think they'll try to do to you? They threw them into the fire, bound. Seemingly hopeless. So I want to take you back to that night in Ponca City versus Broken Arrow. We were down 2-0. And the onslaught by the enemy continued. It was a king tide, so to speak, against us. They kept coming, they kept coming, they kept coming. But then just before halftime, in a very, you can call it a freak, lucky event, the tide changed. A miracle happened, and we got a goal. And at that point, we had held strong after the 2-0 deficit. We held strong, and so we had held them to 2, and now here, just minutes before the end of the first half, we got a goal. Only down 2-1, entering into halftime, the momentum changed. The game changed. It became more competitive, more back and forth, back and forth. And there in the second half, we continued to hold strong, our defense did, and we scored another one. And then it was 2-2. The mighty Broken Arrow, we had tied them. And that is how regulation ended. And because it was the playoffs, we had to have a winner. So we entered into overtime. And in overtime, it was first one scores wins the game. And wouldn't you know, within a few minutes, we get a set kick at about midfield. And I can still remember this, watching it on film later, but the ball was placed, the ball was kicked, it landed in our, or went into their box, their goalie box, and there one of our midfielders put his head on the ball, connected with it, and the ball struck the back of the net of Broken Arrow. We beat them! We beat the mighty broken arrow. We beat him. We won. But man, this was the sweet moment. Watching film a few days later, when that ball hit the net, every single one of their players dropped to the field. Devastated in defeat. Sweet victory, mind you, right? Now, why do I bring that up? Because these three Hebrews were bound. Seemingly dead in the fire. They had experienced a king tide against them. But then God showed up. The tide turned. The winning goal came in. Because when God shows up, everything changes. As we sang again earlier, the battle belongs to God, and the enemy falls. So no matter what you might face, you got to know that God has the victory. The king looks into the fire, and he sees four are walking in the fire, unbound and unharmed, because God is with his people in the fire. Those who cling to him, those who remain loyal to him, faithful to him, those who refuse to conform to the image, he's with them in the fire. So the king orders them, come out. And the people then discover that no harm had come upon them. Remember, all the clothes that they had on hadn't even been touched. They didn't even smell like smoke. And you know, if you've been around a fire, right, that smoke just clings to you. It sinks deep into your clothes, right? They didn't even have the smell of smoke on them. You say, well, why in the world were they delivered from the fire? Here's why, and King Nebuchadnezzar says it. Here's why they were delivered. They, these three Hebrew boys, trusted in him, in the Lord. And they set aside the king's command to bow down to the image. And they yielded up. They offered up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own gods. In other words, if you were here last week, that should cause you to remember Romans chapter 12. Because what did Paul say? I appeal to you, my brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies. Yield up your bodies as a living sacrifice. That's your spiritual worship. What Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you do that. Yield up your bodies as a sacrifice to the Lord. That's your spiritual worship. Don't be conformed to this world or to the image of this world, but instead be transformed by the renewal of your mind. And that's how you defeat the schemes of the enemy. We trust in God. We cling to Jesus. We defy the enemy's command to bow down to his constructed image, no matter the cost, no matter your feelings, no matter your emotions, no matter who's right next to you bowing down. You don't do it. Give up your lives rather than serve or worship any god except for the true and eternal God. Offer up your bodies as a living sacrifice. Don't be conformed to this world, but instead choose the narrow path of transformation by the renewal of our minds, knowing that God is with us in the fire and he will see us through the fire. Listen, God can transform the culture. He can transform your workplace. He can transform that family member. He can transform our community. He can transform you. He can part the seas. He can tear down walls. He can provide food where there seems to be no food, water where there seems to be no water. He can deliver from captivity. He can cause the blind to see. He can cause the lame to walk. He can cause the mute to speak. He can raise the dead. He can deliver you from the fiery furnace. He can deliver you from the lion's den. He can transform your life, your family, everything. All he asks is that we recognize the enemy's schemes, not letting him outwit us, but instead that we walk by faith into the fire. Stand firm, pray, remain loyal to Jesus, remain standing strong on the rock of ages, no matter what. Listen, the enemy seeks to infiltrate, incarcerate, indoctrinate, incinerate. And we'll see next week how this works out on a practical level in our time. But listen, now more than at any other time in our culture's history, Just as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were called, commanded, and compelled, so are we to resist the urge to be conformed to the pattern of this world. We're to remain firm on the rock of God's truth, to choose Christ over self, to go and proclaim that truth to the world so that the truth would set others free just as it set you and I free. But I'm telling you, it will not be easy. As we saw last week, success in conforming to Christ over conforming to the culture will not be easy, because our enemy, our culture, and our flesh have come together like a spiritual king tide. It's as though our feet are standing at the edge of the ocean. Its waves just keep crashing against us, pushing and pulling our feet as we feel the sand's surface just sifting beneath us. And if we're not careful, if we're not on guard, if we don't cling to Jesus, we will be swept away. So many already have. We must choose Christ over self. Our only hope is to cling to the rock of ages, the rock who is Jesus, to stand firm on him, to stand firm with him amidst any kind of chaos or confusion or crisis. No matter our desires, no matter the emotions or the consequences, we're to choose Christ over self no matter what. Meaning, don't be a conformist to the culture. Be a conformist to Christ. And urge others in a spirit of love, grace, compassion, and mission to do the same. Now, let me finish by just reading this quote. It comes from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a man who knew the enemy's schemes as he saw it play out in his own culture. But listen to what he says. He says, "The messengers of Jesus will be hated to the end of time. You will be blamed for all the division which rends cities and homes. Jesus and his followers will be condemned on all sides for undermining family life, for leading the nation astray. They'll be called crazy fanatics and disturbers of the peace. The disciples will be sorely tempted to desert their Lord. But the end is also near. And so they must hold on and persevere until it comes. Only he will be blessed who remains loyal to Jesus and his word until the end." So with heads bowed, eyes closed, I invite our team forward as we have a time of invitation. For some of us, we maybe have recognized just even this morning how the enemy is working on our own life or maybe on our family's life. But no doubt we recognize how he's working on our community and culture's life. We've seen how he's infiltrated. He's gotten access. We've seen how he's taken people captive. We see how he's seeking to deconstruct and to reconstruct people to follow the ways of this world. And we see the pressure that he's putting on individuals to conform to the pattern of this world. So maybe just this time of invitation, just praying for ourselves, for our homes, for our culture, for our community, for all generations to be on guard, to be aware, and for all to cling to the rock of Jesus. And if that's you today, if you're sinking in the ocean, so to speak, the waves crashing over you, cry out to Jesus. He's there to save you. He'll be with you in the fire. He'll see you through the fire. Just cry out to Jesus. So even as I pray, if there's something on your heart, your mind that you just want to, you pray for, you have a decision to make, whatever it is the Spirit's leading you to do, be obedient to that. And if you need to come forward, you can come forward even as I pray. Father, we thank you. We love you. Help us to recognize we're at war. Our enemy is unseen, but he is very active in the seen world, seeking to institute his scheme. Father, help us to be on guard. Help us to be aware of it. Help us to not be naive. Help us to not be woefully unprepared. And help us, no matter what, to cling to Jesus, no matter what. Help us to not conform to the patterns of this world. Help us to have the boldness, the courage, the strength to yield up our bodies to you, to choose you over all self and all culture and all worlds, to choose you over everything. Move in our hearts and minds in this place right now. Be with those hearts and minds offering up prayers to you right now. Answer those prayers according to your will. In Christ's name I pray. As we stand together and sing, this invitation is open to you right now. Myself, Weston, will be down here. You come see us if you need to.